How dramatically has mainstream media in the West distorted what's really going on in the Israel-Gaza assault? How far is Israel going in terms of shaping messages coming from Western journalists about who is the victim and who is the savage in the Gaza Strip? Are journalists in Canada punished for being too sympathetic to the victims of a genocide? How have protests against Israel's actions in Gaza been continuously portrayed as anti-Semitic and as supportive of Hamas by virtually all the major media in Canada? This week on the Global Research News Hour, we are taking on major crimes of disinformation in Western media regarding the 21-month assault on the people of Gaza, which conveniently distorts it to the point where Israelis are the victims and the Palestinians who die by the tens of thousands are all Hamas. How is this task continuously achieved in the age of information? In our first half hour, we hear from reporter Robert Inlakesh about the state of censorship in the conflict currently. And in our second half hour, Jason Tony of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East shows up to introduce listeners to the latest publication from The Breach entitled When Genocide Wasn't News, How Canadian Media Covered Up the Destruction of Gaza. On this week's program, Israel self-defense necessitates the abandonment of journalistic truth. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of July 11th, 2025. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available to partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. This program was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Oji-Cree, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. We have shared in the abundance of resources on this land while acknowledging the past and present injustices against the indigenous people through faulty promises, broken treaties, and force. We acknowledge the crimes of colonialism and genocide which resulted and seek to correct the historical record proceeding into the future through reconciliation and new respectful partnerships. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. But many years passed and the facts were exposed. No attack occurred. Files released by the NSA showed U.S. leaders had distorted intelligence to falsify the incident that fabricated emergency started a conflict that claimed 58,220 American lives and eliminated over 3 million Vietnamese. Right now, every sign points to the setup of another false flag event. That comes from the article, False Flag Incoming, quote, We the People Refuse to be Deceived Again, unquote, Mickey Willis, by Mickey Willis, posted July 9th. Palestinian armed resistance, despite overwhelming odds, has chipped away at Israel's claims of military invincibility. Meanwhile, global solidarity is swelling around Palestinian voices. That's why the crackdown has intensified. Israel isn't just suppressing facts, it's manufacturing a myth of unchallengeable dominance, of Palestinian voicelessness, of a conflict without witnesses. But the archive will not burn. That comes from the article, Killing the Messenger to Kill the Message, Why Israel's Detention of Nasser al-Laham is About More Than Press Freedom, Rima Najjar, by Rima Najjar, posted July 10th, originally published on the author's blog. As if this were not bad enough, Here is what the UN itself points out, namely that, quote, according to information provided by the UN controller to the General Assembly's Fifth Committee, Administrative and Budgetary, only $1.8 billion has been received against the $3.5 billion regular budget assessments for 2025, a shortfall of around 50%, unquote. It should be obvious that the world's government priorities militate against every idea about a less violent and war-ridden world. In 2024, the world spent $2,700 billion U.S. on the military. There are other reasons, but these are enough to make the point that the main fault is with the member states and their behavior rather than with the United Nations as a global institution. If the member states wanted it to be what its founding intellectuals wanted it to be, it would be completely different from today's UN. That comes from the article, The UN at 80, Still Humanity's Most Important Organization, but Member States Deliberately Destroy It, Jan Oberg, by Jan Oberg, posted July 10th, originally published on The Transnational. In conclusion, the West's new hybrid warfare strategy reflects more of a tactical retreat than a breakthrough. It acknowledges that traditional methods have failed, particularly in Ukraine, and attempts to replace lost battlefield momentum with psychological, economic, and technological pressure. But the fundamental assumptions are flawed, that narratives can break national will, that AI can replace strategy, and that propaganda can deliver victory. These beliefs serve primarily to sustain the Western war economy and its elites, rather than offer any real prospect of success. In trying to win a war of perception, the West may once again lose the war of reality. That comes from the article, Western Strategists Launch a New War Doctrine, quote, Prolonged Multidimensional Hybrid Warfare, unquote, Tactical Retreat, by Lucas Lyros de Almeida, posted July 9th, originally published on VT Foreign Policy. Will Washington Israeli hegemonic ambition, together with Russian Chinese Iranian denial, or perhaps avoidance of reality, destroy us in nuclear war? Or will the digital revolution and its bastard child, artificial intelligence, lock up humanity in endless tyranny? I read idealistic accounts of AI in which we all have an AI assistant that manages our daily schedules, our health, diet, weight, and what we eat and drink, manages our investments, protects us against fraudulent bills, keeps watch over our identity and bank account, and ensures all bills are paid, all the while greatly increasing our productivity in our jobs and delivering entertainment. The propaganda makes people feel secure and comfortable, especially really busy people and elderly people, but in fact it makes them insecure and unaware of how insecure they are. All of their information is in one place where it can be hacked or erased along with their identity by an electromagnetic pulse, or EMP. That comes from the article, Two Possible Fates Waiting in the Wings, The Role of AI and Robotics, Dr. Paul C. Roberts, by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted July 9th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. In a June 6th letter, the United Nations Human Rights Office in the Occupied Palestinian Territory Office has verified the killing of 227 Palestinian journalists in Gaza since the 7th of October 2023, including 197 men and 30 women. The letter, written by the office, claims that journalist deaths are not collateral damage in the fighting with Hamas. The targeting of journalists in Gaza and the denial by Israel of foreign journalists to Gaza, except for incidents controlled by the Israeli Defense Forces, indicates a deliberate attempt by Israel to limit the flow of information to and from Gaza and prevent reporting on the impact of its attacks and the denial of humanitarian assistance. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, in an article written on July 9th, the 10-day war between Israel and Iran, as it was called, has only intensified the assault on the press, with Israeli authorities using security fears to increase censorship, and even some extreme right-wing politicians even legitimizing attacks on journalists. This week's episode of the Global Research News Hour is devoted to just those journalists who, in many respects, are just as worthy of accolades as, you know, people who fight fearlessly, supposedly, for freedoms, including freedom of the press. Robert Inlakesh is a political analyst, journalist, and documentary filmmaker. He's reported from and lived in the occupied Palestinian territories and hosts the show Palestine Files, director of Steel of the Century, Trump's Palestine-Israel Catastrophe. Good afternoon, Robert. It's a pleasure having you back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, as I suggested, before we went on air, you personally have had scores of family members killed during the Israel-Hamas war, and you are a journalist who's reported on Gaza for years. From your perspective, what single topic has been so completely distorted by the Western press when it comes to the reporting on the Israel-Gaza war?
Well, it's the entirety of the framing of the war in of itself. Yes, there is a military component to the war itself, but Israel's goal has always been genocide and ultimately a plan to ethnically cleanse the Gaza Strip. It's not fighting a war against Hamas, it's fighting a war against the Palestinian population. And we see that from all of the footage that has emerged over the past 22 months in the Gaza Strip. You can't find videos of the Israeli military actually fighting and engaging in clashes, going after Hamas or going after Palestinian Islamic Jihad or the PFLP, DFLP, or the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades or any of the other smaller groups which are operating there inside the Gaza Strip. But you can find plenty of footage from those same groups, those Palestinian armed groups, engaging in clashes and setting up ambushes, sniper attacks, throwing explosive devices onto tanks, etc., from their side. So the Palestinians have waged this guerrilla warfare campaign against an invading army, but the Israeli military is not actively going after them. There are a few examples of videos showing those sorts of clashes. There are a small number which are the exception and not the rule. Operations by Israeli special forces to either retrieve captives held in Gaza by force or to go after specific Hamas cadres. However, most of them failed and they instantly withdrew. Many Israeli special forces teams were subjected to counter ambushes when they tried to do this. And so they've not attempted to actually go in on the ground and do this sort of style of fighting that they presented at the start to the world. They said, well, we're going after Hamas. We want to dismantle tunnel systems. They admit that they haven't done that. They admit that the number of fighters in Hamas is probably more than it was at the start of the military campaign. And instead, what they've done is they've destroyed the majority of the Gaza Strip's civilian infrastructure. They've blown up or partially destroyed every single hospital in the Gaza Strip, every major military operation that they have waged, whether it be in the north, south, or central Gaza Strip, has always culminated in an invasion of a hospital where they find absolutely nothing of the sort of what they described they were going to find there in their CGI videos that they've depicted. So Israel's not fighting a war against Hamas. They present it as a Hamas-Israel war. Hamas is definitely fighting Israel. They're definitely ambushing them. You can find plenty of footage which reveals this to be the case, but the Israelis are not fighting and going after Hamas directly. They're going after everyone in Gaza. They're using their air force to kill people indiscriminately. If they get Hamas fighters in the midst of that, and occasionally they have intelligence to take someone out, then they will do that, of course. But the goal is to destroy the population of Gaza, and then the hope is that if you just kill so many people and ethnically cleanse so many people, destroy their homes, make Gaza unlivable, then Hamas will cease to be a problem at the end of it. And the vast preponderance of the population, of the Israeli population, agrees with this model. They agree with slaughtering every single person in a city that you capture, for instance. So the whole framing is wrong. They're going after the journalists. They're going after the civilians. They're going after the emergency teams. They're going after the police forces. They want chaos. And now they're backing an ISIS-linked gangster movement, which are they're calling themselves the Popular Forces now. And this group, led by Yasser Abu Shabab, who was a drug trafficker who's looting aid, is even working with their so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which is now weaponizing and privatizing aid using private military contractors who make a buck out of shooting at defenseless civilians and herding them into kill zones where they can retrieve limited amounts of aid. And the Israelis, along with some of these PMCs who have also been recorded shooting at Palestinians, have killed around 600 aid seekers. So, the picture is, it couldn't be more incorrect the way it's presented in Western corporate media.
Yeah, I was wondering. I mean, when you, like these groups. I mean, I remember in Syria, where you had people reporting the white helmets. I mean, they were set up as kind of like the basically coming to the rescue of people damaged by Assad's brutality or whatever. And I mean, is this this group that you mentioned sort of a similar kind of setup where they're kind of taking over some degree of sympathy for them and their message, their story?
Well, the white helmets in Syria had at least a base of popular support in the areas where they operated, and they were accepted around the world, despite their links and many in their ranks being linked to Al-Qaeda groups and obviously operating sort of under the jurisdiction of groups like Nusra, which later became Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which is now the government in Syria. So the situation there is slightly different to what we're seeing in the Gaza Strip. In Gaza, essentially, this group, which is now being presented as the opposition to Hamas, that's what it calls itself, is openly supplied with Israeli weapons, with tactical vests and helmets. Well, you could say that that happened in Syria, not with the white helmets, but they were definitely treated in Israeli field hospitals in the Golan Heights and evacuated through Israeli-held territory in Syria. But in Gaza, what's happened is Israel bombed all of the detention facilities and the prisons for hardened criminals in the Gaza Strip because Hamas was the government in Gaza and had a police and security apparatus in place and its own prisons. Being a government, this is what every government does. And so Israel bombed the entrances to all of these prisons, allowed the prisoners to flee. So you had convicted murderers, you had sexual people accused of sexual abuse, people who were drug traffickers, hardened Salafists linked to Al-Qaeda groups, which Hamas has long fought in the Gaza Strip. This is something that's not covered as well, that Hamas has cracked down on and fought many battles with Al-Qaeda inside of Gaza, Since it came into power, since it took full power in 2007, there have been frequent clashes with Al-Qaeda-linked groups. And then some of these people are linked to ISIS, especially ISIS in the Sinai through familial ties to those militants that existed and some people still exist in the Sinai who pledge allegiance to ISIS. Hamas again in 2015 when ISIS emerged in the Gaza Strip and declared its wing there. Hamas cracked down on it immediately and destroyed it. And some of these figures now who are in this so-called Popular Forces group, which is essentially all they are like I said, criminals, Takfiri militant types linked to ISIS and Al-Qaeda. And they originally were set up after Israel invaded Rafah last year in a portion of southern Gaza to the east in what is a kill zone for any other Palestinian that would enter the space, but a safe zone for these gangsters. And this area specifically was where the humanitarian aid organizations had to bring their trucks through. So what would happen is, under Israeli protection, these gangsters would loot the trucks, or the humanitarian aid organization would have to pay a fine. Some reported they were $4,000 fines apiece to stop their trucks from being looted. Sometimes they were still looted. And then they sort of grew from there. They were widely hated because of the way that they drove the prices up on the black market. And the abuse of civilians, including women and children, that they committed as well when they would sort of enter into areas outside of this kill zone where they had full protection of the Israelis. And now Israel, of course, weaponized them. And the Israelis admit this. They admit it. So it is a different situation to Syria, but it is comparable in many ways because the Israelis do weaponize these hardline elements in order to do their bidding. And in Syria, it succeeded.
Okay, there were incidents of American journalists being in Israel and being detained for reporting on strikes against Israel. I mean, when Iran had struck last year, the country they like to send out reports of their property being undamaged by attacks from Iran. So I mean, Al Jazeera is barred from Israel reporting. So what do you know of what's going on in general in terms of, I guess, restricting access to that kind of information, and the measures that Israel is taking to rise above what is for them inconvenient media resources or narratives?
Well, the restrictions that have been placed on all what they call security incidents has been massive and unprecedented. You mentioned the crackdown frequently on Al Jazeera and the bans imposed upon Al Jazeera and their reporting, but also on the corporate media, of course, there are no international journalists which are allowed to enter the Gaza Strip unless it's under a supervised trip of the Israeli military, where basically they see nothing. They just get taken there to say that they went so that they can do a media tour. People like Douglas Murray go and do that, to pose and claim that they entered Gaza, when really they just entered a buffer zone area where there's no civilian population, and they're just being shown things by the Israeli military that they want them to see. So it's a propaganda tour by a genocidal military, and any journalist that attends these are paid propagandists, and there's nothing else to these people. They're rather pathetic and they're money hungry or ideologically committed to the Israeli cause. And so there's no real international reporting or reporters, international reporters that are allowed into Gaza. But then on the Iran side of things, we have no reports other than an initial report from Haaretz, which claimed that I believe 40 missiles, Iranian missiles, landed in the first day at Israeli military sites. It was either 30 or 40 missiles landed at Israeli military sites the first day. After that, there was a complete blackout. Not only that, but there were these live streams where you could watch, a view of Tel Aviv and of Haifa. And on these live streams, you were seeing the missiles hit live. The Iranian missiles would smash down into central Tel Aviv. What happened is these live streams, not only were they only allowed to film specific areas, but then when the missiles would come in, they would only be able to film the sky. They couldn't actually film what was happening or any missile impacts. So what actually happened with the Iranian missile strikes? Nobody knows. We do know the accuracy of these missiles because of what we saw when those Iranian ballistic missiles pounded areas in central Tel Aviv and in the port of Haifa, for instance, when they hit military and infrastructural targets. But beyond that, we just cannot know. We know the Iranian missiles are definitely accurate. We do know that many of them landed. And we could rationally conclude that many of them hit their targets, but the Israelis just don't reveal the information, and even the casualties. They weren't reporting properly on the casualties, and we see that in the Gaza Strip frequently, that they cover up their casualties, their military casualties, on an unprecedented scale. I mean, it's rather ridiculous the extent to which they cover them up. And that's because their own population cannot deal with the real numbers and the real losses that have been inflicted upon them. They want to buy into a propaganda narrative of both they are the victims, but they're also the heroes at the same time, and they have these wonderful air defense systems, and they're always, superior to their enemies. So they've blocked off everything. The Israeli media can't even do its job. They're not allowed to. And if they try, they'll be put in prison.
Oh, that's Orwellian. Listen, we've got about a minute left, but is there anything else you'd like to say about the state of journalism in Israel, and maybe things that we haven't mentioned yet that should be brought to the attention of the public in Canada, the United States, and in the West generally?
Look, they don't have freedom for their journalists or freedom of speech there. They just don't. They have the veneer of it. But realistically, they can't go against the grain too far, their own journalists, and then they don't allow journalists to properly report from Gaza, and they are trying to cover up their crimes. They're committing a genocide, and they're covering everything up, every single aspect of this. Over the past 22 months, they've covered up and lied about it. So almost everything you hear coming out of the Israeli state and much of its media, because most of its journalists are ex-military and ex-military and intelligence Unit 8200 or Mossad operatives, which go on to be reporters, is propaganda. That's what they're pushing, and then they're murdering journalists in the Gaza Strip.
Yeah, and I guess the more they feel imperiled, the more than they'll admit, the more they've got to clamp down on any security or anything that reveals the truth, right?
Exactly. And that's why they're murdering Palestinian journalists on a scale that we haven't seen. There's more Palestinian journalists in Gaza that have been killed in this war than in World War II and the Vietnam War combined. And it's been that case for a while, and they continue to kill more and more journalists.
I really appreciate you coming on and sharing what you know with our listeners, Robert. Thank you so much. It's on all the best.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking to Robert Inlakesh, a political analyst, journalist, and documentary filmmaker. He spoke to us from Calgary. There's a brand new book hot off the publishing shelf as we go to air. It's called When Genocide Wasn't News: How Canadian Media Covered Up the Destruction of Gaza. It is a fierce, researched, and informed critique of Canadian media misrepresentation of the actions committed by Israel against the people of Gaza and really against the Palestinian people generally. One of the co-editors of the book is Jason Toney. He's the director of media advocacy for Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East. My conversation with Jason Toney begins after a brief break. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. Can you give us a rough idea as to how you chose the essays that you published in a single volume?
Yeah, so this book came together as a collaboration between myself, Martin Lukacs, who's the managing editor at The Breach, and Dania Majid, who is a lawyer and the president and co-founder of the Arab Canadian Lawyers Association. And the three of us worked together closely over a period of months, along with, I'll give a shout out to our wonderful book coordinator, Tyla Scher, who did a great deal of research as well for this book. But we worked together to select a number of essays that we felt captured, in a broad sense, the major issues that we've witnessed in Canadian media's coverage of Palestine, especially since October 7th. So there's a number of sections of the book which will give you a sense of what the book is really about. So we have a section on anti-Palestinian bias, which is it demonstrates very clearly the ways in which Canadian media treats Palestinian lives differently. And some of this is data-driven, and some of it is just narratives about how things are covered and showing some of the double standards that exist. The second part of the book is the fight inside newsrooms. So we actually have firsthand accounts from journalists who were fired or quit over their tensions in the newsroom, issues that came about because of their coverage of Palestine or their posts on social media, etc. So this is really a scathing assessment of what's going on behind the scenes at many of Canada's leading outlets. The third part is about silencing Palestinian narratives. So in this section, we see how Palestinian voices are buried and their perspectives are not treated as equally valid to other voices in Canada or Israeli voices. The fourth is about the Israeli lobby that puts an immense amount of pressure on journalists and editors to cover what's going on in Gaza in an incredibly one-sided way. So we never see the word genocide appear, almost never in Canadian media. It started to creep in, but that's not a mistake. That's because every time Canadian media would cite an Amnesty or International or Human Rights Watch or UN, they face fierce attacks for doing so. They get bombarded with hundreds or thousands of complaints. Part five, we have a voice from Palestine. We published the last essay written by Hossam Shabbat, who is a Palestinian journalist who was murdered by Israel. So we have his final essay. And then to close out the book, we have a Palestine Media Advocacy Toolkit, which was prepared by myself and my colleague Anthony Issa at CJPME, the organization that I work for, which is based on our experience, years of experience doing media advocacy in Canada around Palestine. So I think just giving you the sections gives you a sense of what this book is really about. So it's very thorough, and the contributors are leading Canadian journalists, independent journalists primarily, researchers, and we feel that the book will give journalists or activists or policymakers a real sense of what's going on in the media, what the issues are, and we can begin to think about how to fix this problem.
Could you maybe relate to our listeners some of the more common ways that the media censors Palestinian stories and voices that might persuade even the more skeptical view out there that people may have of media bias toward Israel?
Yeah, so this is where data becomes very useful. So The Breach has done some incredible data-driven research with the help of computer scientists. His name is Ben Cuthbert. And they did an analysis of outlets like the Toronto Star, the Globe and Mail, CBC, and others. Also, the National Post is one of them, one of the biggest offenders. And they show the different ways in which Palestinians count for less. So one of the clearest examples is the number of mentions of Palestinian deaths versus Israeli deaths. So what they found is, despite the Palestinian death toll being far greater than the Israeli one on October 7th, Palestinians were just still mentioned less, which is quite shocking when you think about it. So I think the data component is a really useful way of convincing skeptics, because it's undeniable. The numbers are the numbers, and they speak for themselves, and they show these sweeping trends. So that's how we start off the book. We have a number of essays that speak to data, not just about Palestinian deaths and that kind of reporting, but other ways. So I think that's a very useful way for us to kind of speak to a broad audience and say, look, this is very serious. We have the numbers that show it. And we have to have a conversation about these numbers. We can't ignore them.
Was there anything that surprised even you when you first heard about it?
Yeah, well, one thing that I found shocking was we work, CJPME, my team, the Media Accountability Project, we work with a number of media advocates, people who join our meetings, and we assign them articles to write in response to. So one of these media advocates is his name is Jeff Winch, and there's an article in the book that involves him. It's written by Emma Paling at The Breach. And it tells the story of Jeff complaining to the CBC about the word choice of how they describe what happened on October 7th versus what was happening with Israel's genocide in Gaza. And basically, one of CBC's standards editors wrote to Jeff and told him that while Israelis on October 7th being killed could be described as murderous or brutal and evocative, strong emotive language like that was appropriate, that language CBC didn't feel was appropriate when speaking about the genocide in Gaza. And I found that, even for me, very shocking. The way that was described to Jeff was just totally inappropriate and reveals, I think, this clear editorial bias in terms of word choice. And I think that's a very strong essay that sets the stage for the rest of the book.
Yeah, journalists, they're supposed to be impartial in their coverage, and sometimes people striving to do this are accused of being biased if they show too much sympathy to Palestinians. One of your writers in part two was even gaslit as being mentally unstable. I was wondering if you could, you know, give maybe another example of a journalist that's saying that they're being treated in unfair ways because of their dedication to telling the truths on the ground.
Yeah, I think the essay you're referring to is the whistleblower from CBC who wrote pseudonymously under the name Molly Schumann. And Molly tells the story of working at CBC as a Jewish person who wanted to report fairly on Palestine and the attacks that she was under from editors and higher-ups at CBC and colleagues for trying to express concern about their coverage. So, as you said, I believe it was her who was accused of being mentally unstable for expressing concern about the nature of CBC's coverage. So I think that article was published by The Breach, and it had a huge ripple effect in Canada. And CBC was forced to respond to it, and a number of other outlets picked it up, and it went relatively viral in terms of Canadian media. And I think that story in particular, if you read it, is extremely important in understanding the kinds of things that are going on behind the scenes. And in my work, I have communicated with a number of journalists at major outlets who have expressed similar concerns to me, but they continue to work at these outlets because they want to tell these stories and they continue to push, but they're under attack for doing so. Now, Molly Schumann at CBC was not alone. There are a number of journalists who have come out and told very similar stories at Global News and other outlets, and we've collected some of their stories as well. But it's a extremely unsettling thing to read these stories and realize just how broken our media system is, and how establishment media is just really ill-equipped to report on this issue in Canada, and they don't know how to handle the constant criticism coming from groups like Honest Reporting Canada. And there's all kinds of other vested interests here that are at play. I mean, Canada continues to make shipments of military goods, either to the U.S. that goes to Israel or directly to Israel, that contribute to this genocide. So there's a huge financial component as to why this is. Israel obviously has the status of functioning as a kind of proxy for Western interests in the region. And so media, which is generally owned by a class of people who have connections to these interests, they're not keen to report honestly about what's going on and to rock the boat, so to speak, even in the face of what is increasingly clearly a genocide. And I think people who are doing this kind of Palestine solidarity work feel very comfortable using that term and feel very confident that that is how history will remember this moment.
500 journalists wrote a letter, expressing all these concerns. As far as you know, has there been a reaction by the media themselves?
Yeah, I think it's a mixed bag. I think the reality is that behind the scenes at a lot of these outlets, there is tension. I've had conversations with editors at different outlets across the country, and it really is a mixed bag. And some of it is lip service. They're trying to get us to not be so sharp in our critiques of their work. But there's another part of it, that there is genuine disagreement amongst editorial staff at a lot of these outlets about how they're covering these events. So there is, on one hand, just the weaponization of anti-Semitism, dismissing any critiques of their coverage as coming from that a place of anti-Semitism, which is almost entirely unfounded and misguided. But there are some on the inside who we know are trying to fight against this stuff, who have expressed to us agreement with our positions. So I would say, in general, the concerns of Palestine advocates are dismissed, but behind the scenes, the story is somewhat more complicated than that. So there is, I say this because there is some sense of optimism that things could change, and there are some signs that things are changing in certain ways. There have been a number of victories. I think one, something that wasn't mentioned in the book, but kind of shows what I'm talking about, is there was this moment in time early on after October 7th when CBC's director of public trust, George Achi, made a memo. He sent a memo out to journalists about avoiding the word terrorist when speaking about Palestinian resistance fighters, who are often just called militants or other things. And there was a huge backlash to this. But I think what George was trying to do there, and I have other critiques of him and the way he operated, but I think what he was trying to do there was to ensure that there's some fairness about how Palestinian resistance is treated. Palestinians have the legal right to resist. It's enshrined in international law. And simply reducing any act of resistance to terrorism is a disservice to Canadians who are trying to grapple with what's going on.
It's basically related to the fact that they're occupied, right?
Yes, of course. I mean, there's so many layers we could get into here, yeah. But I think that's an example of the kinds of tensions that exist behind the scenes that have come out publicly. Now, there are others I know about that aren't public, but that's one that was major at the time.
The portrayal of these of the protest outside Mount Sinai Hospital, or it's an epic story in national media, and all the politicians and all the major press came to the conclusion this event was anti-Semitic. They're misrepresenting the reality on the ground. So, I mean, and that the media is playing a role in actually manufacturing news. So you maybe just go through the Mount Sinai incident, and you know how that's something that's you know affecting the way we see this whole Palestine situation.
Yeah, the Mount Sinai story is an absurd one, and I think it's a great example of a larger trend that we see. So basically, you know, a protest passed in front of Mount Sinai Hospital, and the media treated it as if it was a protest against a Jewish hospital, which is wrong and misleading in so many different ways. But the journalists, and I encourage people to buy and read the book, to read the whole story, but the journalists kind of go through all the ways in which that was just not what was actually happening, that this was just a protest that happened to pass this location, and there was no targeting of a Jewish hospital, et cetera. And what I would say about this is, rather than going through the whole details of that particular situation, is explain to people that that was one example of many. Because what we see is, with these protests, the coverage of protests in Canada, is any time they pass a Jewish institution, the media rushes to act as if the protesters were targeting that institution for being Jewish. So we have examples where there was a protest outside of a MP's office, and it was near a, I believe, Jewish daycare or something of that sort. And the media reported on it as if it was a protest outside of a Jewish school, which it was not. It had nothing to do with that that institution being there. It was just totally coincidental. There are countless examples of the media saying that protesters were protesting synagogues, which wasn't the case. It was synagogues happened to be hosting events where they were teaching people how to buy occupied territory, and encouraging settlements and things of that nature, or hosting Israeli soldiers who served in the genocide in Gaza. And rather than reporting on people being concerned, I think very reasonably, about those events, they portrayed them as protests against Jewish places of worship, which again is just completely absurd. People would have protested those events wherever they were. It was just they happened to be at that location. So this is something we see coming up all the time, which again is part of this weaponization of anti-Semitism. It's a way of delegitimizing the concerns of Palestine solidarity activists, and it's meant to just distract from the real issue at hand, which is Israel is waging a campaign of genocide, apartheid, and occupation against Palestinians. That's the issue, and people are concerned about that. And it's very unfortunate, because this misleading coverage, it really has a negative impact on the real issue of anti-Semitism. You know, if anti-Semitism is something we hope to deal with and combat, lying about these protests is not the way to do that, right? It hurts the fight against anti-Semitism. So this is something we hear a lot from you know, our allies at like Independent Jewish Voices, and from a lot of anti-Zionist Jewish people in Canada and the U.S., where there are similar kinds of issues.
There's a lot of we tend to see all the people being interviewed on television, and certainly the Israeli people who've been victims, had a child or a friend or something kidnapped, and they get plenty of room to speak their piece. But there seems to be a kind of a filtering process going on when they bring on a Palestinian to talk about their experience. And I mean, we don't hear the sorts of stories that we've seen from people like that Emmy Award winning Palestinian activist who's recording things as it happens. Could you tell us just a little bit, because I feel that, I mean, we celebrate the diversity, but it seems like there's a filter. There's only certain people who could be allowed on, and some of the filtration policy might not be, very favorable. Maybe certain to conceive to portray a certain kind of goal. Could you just explain that a little bit to that.
What we hear a lot from Palestinians when they're going to be interviewed is, unlike Israelis who are often given the opportunity to do live interviews, Palestinians are forced to make a decision where perhaps they can be interviewed by the media, but there's always the condition that it's pre-recorded.
Yeah.
What that means is that their comments can be edited, and they're not able to speak in real time. And a lot of Palestinians, understandably, are frustrated with that. They're hesitant to take the interviews. And that's a way in which the media really puts Palestinians in an unfair situation that is not faced by Israeli or Jewish voices quite often. So that's an important mechanism for how the media downplays and silences Palestinians. There are many other ways in which this sort of thing manifests. When we hear Palestinians cited, quite often it comes at the very end of a story, where if it's, in print or online, a lot of people don't read to the end of the story. A lot of the times there's a lot of qualifications about this person who's being interviewed that we don't typically see with Israeli voices. Sometimes we'll see an Israeli voice cited in the media, and it's somebody who has all kinds of conflicts of interest or has said deeply racist things publicly many times, and none of that context is brought in. But Palestinian voice, they're always seemingly quick to qualify the statement to introduce doubt and skepticism into the reader or listener's mind before they hear the story that's going to be told by this person.
Okay, we've only got a couple of minutes left, but I was wondering if you could talk about the final chapter, which you co-wrote, and it's basically a checklist or a guide for discerning the useful news from the, or distinguishing the useful news from the propaganda. I mean, could you talk a little bit about that, and I guess maybe ways that we could be helping those journalists who are trying to stick to the their journalistic principles of accountability, transparency, and integrity.
Yeah, so I think the best way to deal with the last chapter, which is the toolkit that was written by myself and a colleague at CJPME's Media Accountability Project, is to tell you a little bit about myself and my background. So I've been to Palestine twice. I went when I was an undergrad two different times. And I was able to kind of explore the West Bank and see what life is like in Palestine. I stayed in a small village and traveled a lot. I have friends there and was able to see firsthand how different the reality is on the ground than what you read in the newspapers. So when I started working with CJPME in February of 2023, it gives one some sense of vertigo reading the stories in the media about this place that I've been and seen, and it's so clearly the reality on the ground is not what's being told to us in the media. What I saw was occupation and apartheid in the West Bank, and it was clear as day. And the stories I heard from Palestinians living there showed me the tear gas that for me was shocking when I was tear gassed at Al-Quds University for helping run a debate conference was Tuesday for Palestinians. They faced that kind of disgraceful violence from Israeli soldiers all the time. So that was kind of my background coming into the work with CJPME. And doing this media work since February 2023, I've just continued to witness this gross disparity between the reality on the ground and what's being told to Canadians. So what we do every day is we read the news. We have media monitoring tools that a number of donors, mostly small donors from around the country, have contributed to you know, setting our team up with the tools we need to do this work. And we write to the media every single day expressing our concerns about their coverage. And the tool is based on this work. So the Media Accountability Project has become a sort of flagship in Canada. There's no one else really doing this work in Canada, and there aren't many groups doing it internationally in other countries. There are some that are popping up, but the work that we're doing, you know, it's inspired by past examples, you know, of groups that were backed by, you know, Noam Chomsky and Norman Finkelstein and people like that. So the toolkit is really just an explanation of how, if you're concerned about these things as an individual and you want to do something, we give you all the resources that we think are essential for doing that work. So if you are listening to this and you're pissed off about what you're hearing, and you're pissed off when you listen to the radio or read the news and or watch the television and you think, this is terribly unfair, well, we give you tools to channel that frustration into meaningful critiques that can really change the narrative. So there's a number of media accountability institutions in Canada where, if you're unsatisfied with your complaint to a newsroom, you can go to a media accountability institution and make a formal complaint, and a council of professionals will assess and decide if they agree that standards were violated by a media institution. We give advice about the kinds of language that seems to work best when making these complaints, the resources you need to understand media standards and ethics, and how to leverage them in your complaints. And you can also join CJPME's Media Accountability Project by becoming one of our media responders. So we have a network of people who we send articles of concern to, and they'll go ahead and write in to the newsroom expressing their concern, sometimes appreciation for a particular piece of journalism. So I'd invite anyone who's listening to not only buy the book and read the book, which you can get from your independent a bookstore or a library, or you can order directly from The Breach. And you can also join the Media Accountability Project. So you can just look us up online and become a media responder. So, yeah, those are the things that I'd offer to anyone listening who wants to get involved in this work and contribute, because the more voices, the better.
Jason, Tony, thank you very much. We really appreciated your work, and this is a great book. So thank you so much for introducing it to us.
Yeah, really appreciate it.
Jason Tony is the Director of Media Advocacy for Justice and Peace in the Middle East. That concludes our show. Next week, stay tuned for a special episode devoted to Eve Engler, who will be running for the leadership of the federal NDP. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.